Welcome to the Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast. I'm Lisa Towers, Managing Editor of Digital Content and Specialty Publishing. This is part two of our three-part series on mergers and acquisitions. In this episode, HFMA President and CEO Joe Pfeiffer talks with Paula Reichle, CFO for Sparrow Health System, as they provide insights into health system mergers and acquisitions. Then, Michael Raddatz, a consultant for Witt Kiefer, talks about the effect of mergers and acquisitions on the CFO role.
Welcome, Paula.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Why don't you introduce yourself and our listeners to Sparrow Health System?
So as Joe said, my name is Paula Reichle. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Sparrow Health System. I've been here at Sparrow almost 9 years. Previous to that, I spent 17 years at the competitor, which is about 2 miles away, last known as McLaren Greater Lansing. When Joe and I worked together, it was Ingham Regional Medical Center, and he hired me to be his controller. And then as he moved on to bigger and better things, I became the CFO. So I've been a CFO for almost 20 years and been in healthcare for about 25 years. As I said, I work at Sparrow, and it is a large, integrated, mid-sized health system, $1.3 billion in revenue. We have one large flagship hospital based in Lansing with 650 beds, and then we have a series of small hospitals in a big ambulatory footprint over about a 5-county region. And we have a health plan. While small at 60,000 members, is very well integrated with our delivery system and doing a lot of really good things with our clinically integrated network. All told, we have about 840 licensed beds across the system. So a nice integrated system that has about 60% of the market share. So we're, you know, definitely the market leader in our region.
You know, that's really interesting. I'm sure people know of Sparrow around the country and think of you as a delivery system. Probably not that many people would realize that you have a health plan, and PHP is the name of the health plan. And, you know, that really is a true integrated network. You know, that term gets bantered around a bunch, but you have experience in trying to balance those conflicting agendas. And so that really is the full integration. You have a pretty good footprint in your most direct community there.
Yes, they represent about 20% of our top line revenue too. So even though a small health plan, still a major contributor to our revenue and our bottom line profitability.
Absolutely. We talked about a little bit about our history together, but you came in not long after we did that first merger of Lansing General Hospital and Ingham Medical Center. And while you weren't there during that merger, you know, the proper itself, but, you know, those things take years to clean up, and I think you got to participate in that. And then you lived through the, we had a time when we were, as an organization, working with, who was that at that time, Columbia HCA, on one of those 50-50 joint venture deals, and we never quite pulled it off. The Attorney General in the state of Michigan blocked that transaction from going forward, but boy, we worked together on that and learned a lot about mergers and acquisitions at the time. And then eventually, did the deal with McLaren, and you got to participate in that full process, and which was a great background for the rest of your career, I'm sure.
Certainly learned a lot in each of those opportunities. The Columbia HCA merger really gave us a really detailed inside look on for-profit healthcare and the way Columbia ran their business. You know, even though that deal went through, I remember we learned so much. We had one of our best financial years after we walked away from that deal because we had done so much really good work on productivity and optimization of the entire organization. So I've always, you know, appreciated that view and oftentimes refer to some of those learnings from, you know, what is now 20 years ago. Certainly the McLaren deal. That was when McLaren was still just becoming a health system. They had one large hospital, one small hospital, and we were the third hospital in. So really got the opportunity to watch them turn into a system over several years and how they integrated their multiple acquisitions. And I think that was very helpful to me as I moved over to Sparrow and actually then was in a system role and had to figure out, okay, how do we lead these types of things with a different hat on, not being the, you know, a hospital that gets acquired, but being the health system that is actually trying to do the integration with new affiliates. So I think that served me well over many years. But
yeah,
the Columbia HCA merger was a lot of fun. They were sort of like the market leader at the time, and it was a merger that was pretty unusual for its time. Certainly would have been the first for-profit hospital in the state of Michigan, which actually didn't end up occurring until about 20 years later. So
the finance guys that worked with us on that deal is Bill Rutherford, who's now the CFO of HCA, and so we get to see him every once in a while.
Don't burn any bridges. You never know who you might be working for.
You know, you mentioned you learn a lot, and you really do. And sometimes you laugh, you think there's things that you learn that you wish you never did. But why don't you give us a sense of how many of the Sparrow transactions you've been through and maybe the size and nature of some of those transactions?
So most of the hospital transactions have been relatively small critical access hospitals. Once you get outside of Lansing, you're about 60 miles away from any other city, whether that be Grand Rapids, the Detroit area, or Ann Arbor. And our system has never been one to be like acquiring hospitals, you know, hundreds of miles away from our main headquarters. And really, the decisions to do those types of things really go back to our strategy, who we want to be, which communities we want to serve. And that really drives our ability to determine whether we want to engage in a conversation, whether that be an RFP comes our way, or we're approached by a board or a CEO about a potential affiliation. You know, we really always tie it back to our strategy. Who do we want to be, and what do we think we're good at? So we have never really traveled very far afield. Our farthest hospital is 45 minutes away.
Yeah, Michigan's kind of unique. You know, every state is different, but Michigan's got these handful of really significant regional players that are pretty sizable in their given primary service area, but there really hasn't been though that statewide network developed like you see in other states. And so that geographical footprint that you described, there's a lot of that in the state of Michigan.
I mean, you could take every sort of mid-sized city once you get out of southeast Michigan, and it's duplicated, whether it be Kalamazoo or Saginaw, Lansing, Grand Rapids. The size and scale might vary, but it's really very similar because people don't travel that far for healthcare, and that's really sort of one of our basic tenets is, you know, people want healthcare delivered as close to home as possible, and that's really how we sort of run our business.
Absolutely. You know, I was curious as to how your deals come about. I mean, do organizations approach you? Do you approach other organizations? Who calls who?
Well, I think it's all of the above because every deal is slightly different. Usually we start by developing relationships first. So we are friends first. We help other organizations out that need assistance, whether that, you know, be clinical assistance or financial or otherwise. And we build a relationship sometimes between the executive team, sometimes at the board, sometimes even physicians have relationships. And then we begin conversations. We've had those kinds of mergers that just evolve out of these long-standing relationships. We've had one or two where the organization was in real financial distress and really needed us to help. That would be our Ionia location that probably wouldn't be there if it wasn't for Sparrow stepping in and, you know, helping them figure out how to serve the community. Then we have others that are much slower. Some we've worked on for years, literally, developing relationships, and some which still haven't even come to fruition, even after years of relationship building. So I would say they come about in various different ways. At least that's our experience.
You said something interesting. You talked about what management was doing, but you also talked about the board. So tell me a little bit about describing the management versus board involvement, how that works, how important it is. And again, who really drives the deals? Is every deal kind of unique in and of itself?
You know, I would say that at least on the management team side, there's a couple key players on our side that guide those deals. The CEO, the CFO, and probably the COO are the typical people that are involved in the actual conversations and the deal itself. We have done several of these smaller hospitals, so the deal has become more templated in a way. You know, we sort of have the structure and we have plans to make that work. But, you know, usually it's our executive team, some representatives from the other entity, the hospital, and usually we have a board member with us. It really helps the other entities to have a governance person at the table with their governance, because typically the smaller hospitals will bring their board chair at least, and they want to have that board-to-board interaction. You know, once the conversation has reached a point of the deal sort of in place and we're ready to go and now we're going to move into execution, then we see the governance fall off, and then it becomes, you know, just management that does those kinds of things. At times, that governance involvement has been very beneficial.
I would imagine that if one side gets too far in front of the other, it could be a problem.
Yes. And it helps us because we can move a little faster because we have somebody from governance at the table, so we don't have to keep doing a third-party relay to our board about what's going on, and they can help support either our decision to say, you know, we're recommending this transaction or we have concerns about this transaction.
Well, and the same would go for those communities, especially with the size of organizations and the size of the communities that you mentioned. Then in those communities, those hospitals are... they're more than just a hospital. I mean, they're the largest employer. They're part of the culture. So there's a lot of emotions that get tied up into those communities. And I'm sure that plays out in that board and management relationship as well.
Absolutely. The loss of control or the fear that, you know, a large other entity is going to come in and take services out of the community. It's a fascinating look at the culture of what hospitals mean to every community they're in, large and small. And so you really have to have an appreciation for that. And it's different than, you know, an RFP that gets issued for a 300-bed hospital.
Yeah, you think about it. And I know to those small communities, you guys are the big bad bullies, right? Coming from Lansing and you're the big city and, you know, you're these potentially terrible people. And so you have to convince them that you're really not. You know, that's all part of that communication and board and management process.
Well, you know, we've had such success with our affiliations with small hospitals. You know, if there's some serious conversations going on, we will engage board members and management from some of our existing small affiliates to talk to the board and management team of a potential affiliate, which has been really, really great. We cannot toot our horn nearly as good as the people that we have shown with action and implemented the things that we said we were going to do during the merger conversations. They do a far better job of telling the story.
Yeah, if nothing else, they could vouch for integrity. Whether they like your answers or not, at least they know that you speak with integrity, and that's just critical in one of those deals. I want to follow up on one thing you said quickly, because you said some of the hospitals were, you know, financially distressed, and I'm sure they were coming for capital. I had the same conversation earlier with Kevin Brennan, and he talked about how many of the hospitals that they're dealing with at Geisinger's, their capital now that they're really looking for is for EHR or other IT issues. And that's really different from a few years ago where, you know, hospitals were looking for capital to build something new. What are you experiencing? What are the hospitals looking for? Whether they're financially distressed or not, in terms of capital, are they looking for IT capital? Are they looking for bricks and sticks? Both? What's your experience been?
I would say over the last several years, it's definitely IT rises to the top. Almost every affiliation we've done, we've had a commitment to install Epic, which is what we use system-wide as part of the affiliation. That connectivity and that technology upgrades that we can bring to smaller hospitals is really, really important to them. The other thing is subspecialty care, because of the way that these hospitals are in smaller communities. So help recruiting physicians, sending specialists from Lansing to do clinics out in our smaller communities is really, really important to them. Bringing care to their community, oncology, cardiology, neurology, those seem to be like the really big needs that they have that they cannot fulfill on their own, because they can't recruit a neurologist for a small community that you can't keep them busy 5 days a week.
So I want to jump into the other thing that came out in the Deloitte study was a discussion about culture. Understanding the culture, ensuring cultural alignment was a key theme in many of our conversations. But from a Sparrow perspective, how does your management team collaborate with and work with the leadership team from other hospitals? How do you identify what the culture needs are, or how do you ensure that they're compatible?
Well, certainly during the early conversations about a potential transaction, you get a really good sense of where people are. And I will tell you, every entity, which is probably not a surprise to anyone listening to this, is completely different. They each have their personality, whether it's the CEO or the board. Some people are really excited about it and others are really not, even though they might really know that it needs to happen. They may not be nearly as all in. So we assess the culture, certainly, you know, when it's a good mesh, it's easy because everybody wants it to happen and wants it to be successful. It isn't always, but over time, you can sort of get people to come along. And, you know, I'm sort of a believer, like the proof's in the pudding. So once they come on board and we actually deliver and behave the way we say we were going to behave, people figure, oh, okay, now I understand. This is really how this works. I think honesty and transparency work really well. So I've learned over the years, just tell them the truth. Because if you try and say, oh yeah, we're really good at that. Sometimes we're not that good at things, and we need to say we haven't figured that out yet, and so we're working on that, and we don't know how to do that quite right. And I think that that goes a long way too, because people know what to expect. So culture is about trust in my mind, and it's about proving that you do what you say you're going to do. And occasionally, though, some people have to leave, or they choose to leave on their own because they don't want to be part of whatever our culture looks like. So I think it can be tough at times.
So I would imagine that when you do your deals, there's certain types of corporate services that are provided, whether it's revenue cycle or purchasing or general ledger, or then you talked about some of the clinical areas. How do you go about deciding? Is that just a model that you just roll out and then it's one of communicating upfront with the other organization, or is that something that's negotiated, or how do you go about deciding who does what once the deal is done?
Well, I've been here almost 9 years. So when I first got here, we didn't have a model. We didn't really have corporate services. Everybody was just sort of doing their own thing. And as you can imagine, knowing me, that didn't last that long.
Right.
I needed to have a process. So
exactly.
we are pretty heavy corporatized. You know, we have consolidated all revenue cycle, all finance, reimbursement, all our IT is consolidated. So we don't have a lot of those services. You know, there's HR people on site, but all the backroom functions are consolidated. Payroll, AP, all of that is done centrally. So at this point, when we talk to new people, we tell them, here's how it works. And we're close enough to most facilities that if somebody wants to come with the work, we can do that in most cases. But we are getting to the point where we won't always be able to do that. We won't be able to take all the individuals that work in a facility. We talk about it up front. We have a plan way in advance, and we work the plan with the organization.
Again, it's the same concept, you know, just be clear, act with integrity, talk up front, and say what you mean and mean what you say. Well, I would imagine that, I don't know if this is a challenge or not for your organization. I've seen this in some others where it's a little bit of a challenge where different people in management have a different, maybe just a slight, you know, nuanced difference in terms of corporate services and what's provided and what isn't. You know, maybe the deal makers are up front saying, or what's heard is, oh, you can keep doing whatever you need to do. And then somebody else comes along and say, no, we're going to make this corporate. I would imagine that the need for the Sparrow management team to be totally in sync on what's provided and what isn't is really important.
Extremely. Because you don't want someone going in and telling them, well, we're going to do it this way, and no one gave them any notice on that, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
We have a pretty prescriptive approach. It's IT, it's HR, it's finance. You know, those disciplines are really the corporate services. And at this point, our team's probably on deal 4 or 5 of trying to do this. And we do this with a lot of practices, too. So, you know, I've been referring to hospitals, hospitals, but we have acquired a lot of physician practices, which it's the same thing. We have to go in with IT, centralized management. So, you know, it's a much smaller issue, but maybe sometimes even more difficult because, you know, we're talking about independent physicians learning how to work in a health system, which is not an easy transition for them. IT is really the driving force there too.
That's really a key point, you know, and this Deloitte study focused on the hospitals, but my gosh, when you think about the physician deal, sometimes there's a lot more emotion involved because those are, you know, much of their life has been put into creating that practice, and then you're coming in and taking that over. So I would imagine those conversations are even more important than the physician transactions, or certainly more emotional than the hospital deals.
Yeah, they are challenging, definitely. You know, we have like a really large cardiology group who you are familiar with, and they've been part of us since 2010, and they still have transition issues 8 years later because they had such a culture of running their own business.
So culture is really important. Let me shift gears a little bit here, and I think the term you used was strategic discipline, but, you know, one of the keys of success that came out of the Deloitte study was the need to have a strong strategic rationale for the deal, that it's more than just economies of scale. So you mentioned it. Tell me a little bit about it. How does Sparrow maintain a strategic discipline when you evaluate a transaction?
You know, we sort of believe in this footprint in Lansing and then reaching out. So if we're jumping other communities or moving so far afield geographically, we ask ourselves, what is that doing for our organization and our mission and vision of who we want to be, other than simply we just added another $200 million in revenue to our... And there's systems, ones we worked for who have a complete footprint all over the state of Michigan and have acquired multiple hospitals. That's their strategy, not a bad strategy, just not our strategy. And so to know what you're good at and where you don't want to compete, I mean, we have just turned down an RFP that was out because it just didn't fit with our strategy. You know, we could have bought another hospital, I guess, and added some more revenue, but we couldn't find a strategic synergy to what our strategy is. And that may come back to haunt us. You know, maybe we'll be too small someday and we won't be able to be independent and sustain ourselves. But up to this point, our strategic discipline has been good for us and good for our financial performance.
So you're not looking for charms on the charm bracelet?
No, we are not. Never have been. Yeah. And now we've sort of shifted that belief that it's not about bricks and mortar hospitals necessarily. It's about managing lives and population health and really leveraging our health plan in addition to still providing those tertiary services that we have to in our community. But that may not be what the metric is hospital beds at some point.
Absolutely. And that's a discipline and a capability that you have by having a health plan that somebody else may not, in terms of taking risk. And what does that really mean?
In our health plan, what we like to say, you know, everyone wants to talk about risk and capitated contracts, and we like to tell them we've been taking risks for 30 years. It's not all it's cracked up to be.
No kidding. I said that in jest, but it's no big deal. One of my observations over the years is that people that are purely in a hospital really underestimate the complexity of taking risk and what it means to underwrite premiums in a health plan. That's harder than it seems on the outside.
You know, it has really become much more integrated in the time that I've been here. I mean, we have our people working shoulder to shoulder between the health system executives, the health plan executives, and certainly our clinically integrated network and our employed medical group. So a lot of synergy going on there, which I think is really exciting and is going to actually, you know, contributes to our potential success.
What's one lesson you've learned from the transactions that you'd like to share with others that I didn't cover in these questions?
I think I learned the lesson from being on the receiving end of the transaction more than anything. So, you know, I think that learning to be a health system is really hard. And as health systems are growing, they really don't know how to do it well. So the benefit of having been a CFO of an organization that was acquired and watching the health system figure out how to behave like a health system was really beneficial to me, because I've been able to turn and use those lessons, both good and bad, because certainly there was a lot of good that I saw too, and apply them to my role at Sparrow. And, you know, I like to think that I do it better because of all the lessons that I've learned. And I try to be fair and understanding of the other person's position, but I also try to do the right thing for the organization. And sometimes not everyone wins in that equation, but I do think that having been on the other side of it and been the recipient of a merger was probably the best thing that ever happened to me and why I think I do a good job with it.
Absolutely.
Health system CFO when I have to make tough decisions.
Well, a little empathy sometimes can go a long way. And it doesn't mean you stray from what you need to do, but that's a great point. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. Well, hey, Paul, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to serve, and I've met a lot of great people, and every time I'm engaged with HFMA, I learn something new. So it's a great organization to be part of.
Wouldn't it be great to provide your staff with unlimited access to HFMA's library of online education? How about HFMA's accredited certification programs, market-leading white papers, in-depth research reports, and more? Introducing Enterprise Solutions, a group membership program designed to provide your organization's employees with cost-effective tools and resources that increase staff engagement and optimize organizational results. Get your organization engaged with Enterprise. For more information and to watch an introductory video, visit hfma.org/enterprise.
This is Betty Hinch, senior editor of HFMA's forums and newsletters, talking with Michael Raddatz, a consultant with Witt Kiefer, on the impact of mergers and acquisitions on the CFO role, as well as new skills required of today's successful finance leaders. Michael, welcome to HFMA's Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast.
Thanks for having me, Betty.
In a recent article in HFMA CFO Forum, you mentioned that CFO appointments or hiring is increasingly based on evaluating the existing team surrounding the CEO and what skills, traits will complement the team. Please expand on that trend and add any others that you are seeing in terms of CFO hiring.
You know, we've seen so much transition over the past few years in healthcare, with new CEOs, new members of the C-suite across many organizations. You know, really, anytime you add a person, a new CEO, for example, you're changing the dynamics, certainly. That individual is going to have a new vision for the organization, and that doesn't just include the CEO. I mean, if you add a new chief strategy officer, a new HR leader, everyone's going to have a different dynamic, bring a different dynamic to that senior leadership team. So you really need to find a complementary skill set. You need to make sure that everyone works well together, and that includes the CFO. So really what we're seeing now in CFOs, depending on the size and the need of the organization, they're serving as a strategic advisor to the CEO in many respects. So CFOs, I think, in the past had a reputation of not wanting to spend money and being someone that would say no, almost maybe like a cop, like a compliance officer used to be viewed. We're seeing that change. Today, a CFO tends to be a little bit less risk-averse. They're more creative. Of course, they have the great business sense. They're an enabler of the business. They have really good ideas, and they're that sounding board for the CEO and the rest of the C-suite. They bring good M&A experience, mergers and acquisitions. We see CFOs needing to have a strong background in business development, great understanding of payer strategy. That's going to be important for any CFO, especially of a larger organization where they're helping to manage payer contracts across different markets. Experience with EMR implementation, as we know, that's happening all the time. Systems are upgrading and making a significant investment. So that's not only a big dollar figure, but experience with that and how that can disrupt the business. A CFO having that experience will be critical. And then operational efficiency, understanding how to gain efficiencies across an organization will be important. So it's much more than just managing a balance sheet. There's a lot more nuance, I think, to the CFO roles today. Health system growth has created a lot of opportunities, and there's been retirements as well. So there are opportunities out there, and we're being asked to do more finance searches at different levels across health systems. So whether that's a VP of finance at a hospital that's part of a larger system, or it could be a vice president of revenue cycle at a health system because they're taking a more of a shared services approach at these larger systems. So there's a lot more different finance opportunities in the market. And lastly, the educational component always comes up on these opportunities. You know, is it an MBA? Is it a CPA? Do we require both? Is it one or the other? Recently, I looked back at CFOs of the 100 largest hospitals and systems, and it's almost a 50-50 split between those that have the MBA or the CPA. So we're seeing our clients have more of a willingness to be open with that requirement. It's always going to be one or the other. It used to be both, but now we're just seeing one or the other for the majority of the time. So having that strong educational or experiential background, being a creative CFO and someone that could be a sounding board for executive leadership is really what we're seeing out of CFOs today.
I'd like to focus in on mergers and acquisitions. Can you share more on the impact of hospital mergers and acquisitions on CFO positions?
Well, the impact that we're seeing now more than ever is the activity in the market. So over the past 12 months, there have been a number of CFO opportunities out there. The market was a little bit slower for a while previous. Coincidentally, at that time, we did see some big CEO opportunities out there in the market as well. So one could only guess that was because organizations were taking some time to consider what that new CEO would bring to an organization and how they would like to move forward. But now it's a very active market. Some of that is due to academic systems becoming more involved in community hospitals, growing and acquiring and partnering with community hospitals. So it's very different to be the CFO of an academic medical center than it is to be the CFO of an academic medical center that also has a number of partner hospitals and communities that are not academic in nature. Large not-for-profit health systems growing, just in general, community-based not-for-profits. And then it's no secret that some of the investor-owned systems as of late have been eliminating some roles and transitioning how they look at their markets and their regions. So we're really seeing a lot of opportunities in the market, different opportunities, and we're seeing a lot of individuals looking at new opportunities due to these mergers, acquisitions, due to the need to look at efficiencies, making sure that these systems can stay viable in the future. Health system growth due to these mergers and acquisitions leads to questions around the definition of the role. To get back to my earlier comments, the new skill sets needed, whether that is a high-level person to manage the investments and work with board committees. At the market level in the regional CFOs, we're seeing more of these positions, and that's really about translating system strategy at the market level and then helping to operationalize that. And then these shared services roles more, these VPs of revenue cycle, the system VP of financial operations, these system roles that are deployed, it's one individual being deployed across the system to help build efficiencies across the system. So we're seeing more of that as well, due in part to the mergers and acquisitions and the growth of these health systems. So what this means moving forward is financial leaders, I think they could really take time to figure out what they like to do. Do they really enjoy the investment piece and working with boards? Maybe they should think about being a system CFO and think how they can take the steps to get there. If they have a strong financial operations background, maybe it's that regional CFO position, or maybe it's that market CFO, where they can really have involvement with the health system, but also work with those site CFOs at those hospitals. So they get a balance of operations and strategy. Or is it someone that really enjoys the revenue cycle or has a strong accounting background and they want to be a controller at a larger system? So the mergers and acquisitions is really changing how financial roles are structured, and it's creating new and interesting opportunities in the market.
Other major changes are the Affordable Care Act and ongoing health care reforms. Have those had any impact on the CFO role and hiring market?
When you think back to the ACA, when it was signed into law, I think it was in 2010, systems began thinking about how do we continue to account for quality and how do we align incentives to be based on quality, looking at physician contracting, looking at payer contracting differently. Then you start to see some more creative partnerships between not-for-profit or for-profit health systems and other entities, you know, partnerships with physician groups and joint venture arrangements and micro-hospitals and all these trends, looking at ways to maybe think about how can we offset maybe some of our inpatient revenue with some other arrangements out in the marketplace. At the same time, the health systems began managing their investments, and I shouldn't say more closely, but there maybe was a little bit more of a focus on that, and you saw some big health systems do quite well financially based upon a stronger focus on those investments and focusing on philanthropy as well, ways to offset what could have been losses on patient revenue. And then in 2008, the market crashes, of course, and so with that, you saw people not making moves and staying on a little bit longer. And in talking to CFOs, in my experience, it seems like some of those that may have been thinking about retirement around 2007, 2008, 2009 have continued to stay on. And so now, obviously, with the market at a level we've never seen before, with health systems continuing to grow, which creates different opportunities, we're starting to see maybe an uptick in retirements and some increased opportunity in the market. There's much more of a focus on integrating, operationalizing systems as well, to make sure that they're at a point where they have scale and they can enhance efficiencies as a response to the ACA. Newly formed organizations, like I mentioned a couple of times, they're looking for a different style and a different skill set. And as CEOs start thinking about structure and ways to gain efficiency, they want expertise to manage that more closely. The last piece is the patient experience, and probably most importantly, the patient experience. The ACA really encouraged organizations to focus on this, and CFOs are much more conversant in that space than they probably were years ago. Focusing on what quality means, how do business development initiatives affect quality? If we're going to form a partnership with an organization, how are we going to make sure that they continue to provide quality care that is up to that organization's standards? Payer contracting and external relationships are important. A poorly negotiated contract can have a negative effect on an organization, so having expertise in that area is more important than ever. And we're seeing managed care contracting and payer contracting tend to fall under a CFO if it's not them, it's someone on their team, just about all the time now. And so having a system that is relevant is not just about size, it's also about having scale and the ability to have new initiatives across multiple markets and remain strong and remain relevant. And what relevant is in one market could be very different than another. So it's not, in my experience, a dollar figure. It's about providing quality care and having a strong reputation and doing the right thing. So moving forward, considering all these changes, health systems probably want to look beyond just a resume. You know, look at the strategic acumen of CFOs, exposure to different markets, really the ability to combine strategy and operations. The CFO market is so dynamic right now that those looking for a new opportunity really have choice. And like I said before, really should think about what do they want to do next and be thoughtful about their approach to that. Because I'm sure if there's an interest, there's an opportunity to match that interest in the market right now. CFOs should be aware of their strengths, of course, so to have some self-awareness and also be able to form that strong partnership with the CEO, serve as that strategic advisor, because that's really what many CEOs are looking for today.
Thank you, Michael, for sharing with our listeners your thoughts on trends in CFO skills.
Thank you.
Podcast listeners can read an article from HFMA CFO Forum that features more of Michael's comments at hfma.org/CFO Forum/CEO Collaboration.
Are you interested in extending your organization's thought leadership? Connect with HFMA listeners by sponsoring an upcoming podcast. For more information and to discover all the ways you can partner with HFMA, visit us at marketingopportunities.hfma.org.
You've been listening to the Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast. For more information about these and other topics, visit hfma.org.